first thing we learn, the first impression we learn is oppression of animals. And if we can take care of that, that I believe is the root of all problems. And then we can, you know, expand better once we, you know, learn to end that oppression.
I think the world should go vegan because every being on this planet has the right to life, the right to exist, and the right to live in peace, completely free from oppression.
Welcome, listeners. I'm glad you are here.
Welcome back to another episode of the Live Vegan Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Leahy, and as always, we are joined by Ben Lawa. And today we're going to talk about something that comes up very often in the animal rights community and in the vegan movement, and that is how to focus our efforts. Do we focus on animal suffering exclusively and the justice or injustice of animals, and not focus on human suffering or the justice or injustice of humans? And how do those two things fit together? Should we focus on both? Should we just focus on one? And obviously, our take, Ben and I both believe that they're not mutually exclusive, that we can do both. We can very actively say that animals deserve rights, that animals deserve better, while also saying the same about humans. And when we see injustice being done to humans, we don't have to just commit ourselves to the injustice of animals. We can say that's wrong too, right? Both forms of injustice are wrong. And we are not hypocritical in taking a stand against both. In fact, the opposite, we think we are consistent in taking a stand against both. So today's guests are going to discuss these ideas with us. And today's guests are Eloisa Trinidad and Tom Ramage, who has joined us on another episode in the past, so we're happy to have him back. They are co-founders of the Vegan Activist Alliance, and we're going to discuss the creation of that organization, as well as all the things I just mentioned. So hope you enjoy this episode. And here we go. Okay, welcome to the show, Eloisa Trinidad and Tom Ramage. Today we're going to discuss a little bit about human rights and how it is connected to the animal rights movement. And you are both co-founders of the VAA organization, which has been exploding in popularity in recent months. So thank you for joining us. We're excited to have you.
Excited to be here.
Thank you for having us.
All right, let's start from the beginning then. What is Vegan Activist Alliance, and where did it come from? Why did your team decide that this is something that was lacking in our movement and something that needed to be created?
So Vegan Activist Alliance is an animal liberation organization. I like to be specific about that because that is what we're fighting for. And we take an anti-speciesist, abolitionist, anti-racist approach to liberation. And we believe in total liberation, collective liberation, always centering the animals because that is the work that we do. And, you know, working or in volunteering with previous organizations, we have felt that there was a need for that due to issues of inclusivity as well as accountability. And, you know, when we got together, I think some of us were disappointed in the way other organizations were being ran. And, you know, we saw that there was a space there for us to continue the work and, you know, give activists options and not walk away from the work without having something in place.
Great. So what kind of work is it exactly? What do you guys normally do on a regular basis for those who don't know?
So part of what we do and what we're focusing on right now is educational activations. Some of the activations that we've had have been experiential, meaning that we're trying to really engage the audience, not just through video images, but also through food, literature, performance art. Recently, on July 4th, we had an activation that dealt with liberating animals, obviously, from work and from and their independence as well. And we had performance art, we had poetry, we had music, which was really engaging in the audience, you know, found it not just entertaining, but we were talking about the plight of animals. So it was also informative. So our activations, while focusing on the traditional video outreach, is also expanding into other forms of connecting with passersby.
So it's street activism.
Is street activism. We're also collaborating with various organizations, doing vigils as well as working on slaughterhouse initiatives.
Okay, great.
And also, don't forget, we're also doing, we're partnering with Chili's on Wheels, doing some pandemic relief too, providing food for people with needs.
Right. So during that pandemic, we partnered up with Chili's on Wheels, which is a vegan food justice organization. Chili's on Wheels has been around for about 6 years. They have done quite a bit from, you know, the typical emergency food relief to micro sanctuaries. And while doing this pandemic relief, partnering up with them, we're also educating people on veganism, on animal ethics. And, looking towards building alliances with other organizations. So that's the other part of what we're looking to do, empower activists and also build a stronger movement by collaborating with different organizations. And we've done that so far with various organizations in New York City.
I noticed you use the term activation. Is that it's just a synonym for activism, or is that just... Or did you use that intentionally for like a different meaning?
Go ahead, Tom.
No, I'm just interested because I haven't heard that. I'm like, okay, wait, what is?
We're calling our outreach events activations because it's a chance to activate the public consciousness into what's happening and activate vegans into becoming activists. So activation was like a very good word for that.
I like it. Is that something your team came up with, or was it like taken from some literature somewhere else, or?
Yeah, I believe I came up with it.
Yeah, that's cool. I've never heard that. And when you said it, I'd like to learn more.
You know, I think that we're trying to get away from what's already established and understand that what we're doing is activism. It's not a brand. It's not just a type of activism. We want to empower our activists. And so we just felt that the word activation was more descriptive of what we were looking to do, especially because we're looking to add different parts to it, not just the dialogue and not just the video footage. So because it is sort of experiential and my background is in business development, I thought that it was a good word and I ran it by the team and, you know, we kind of stuck with it.
Yeah, I love it. You mentioned how activism isn't a brand. So I kind of want to expand on that a little bit. So, you know, someone may come across an organization or be working with an organization for a while because they like their tactics. They like what they're doing and how they're reaching out to the public. But then finding, you know, maybe there's other things about the organizers or the team or even the organization that they don't agree with, whether it's, you know, has to do with human rights and how it connects with animal rights. So there are people out there that feel that way, but still keep doing the activism because, or stay with that initial organization because they feel that that's the only way to use that tactic. So
well, it could be, Ben, sorry to interrupt. It could be as simple as their schedule doesn't fit with your schedule, right? But you still want to do the same kind of activism.
Well, yeah, I just, Well, maybe. Right, right. So I don't know if I'm making a point or if I'm asking a question here, but I think it's important that people realize that, you know, no one owns activism. No one owns certain tactics. And, you know, I know VAA is using tactics that other groups do. So I love, you know, I just want to mention that there is options. You know, you don't have to, like you said, with the brand. So was that something that was really important to starting this out?
Absolutely. I think that was probably one of the main points besides the inclusivity and consistent anti-oppression that we adhere to. Empowering each person to know and believe that they have, you know, equal input in the fight for liberation to us is extremely important. We think that everyone can be either trained or helped into organizing work, or if that's something that doesn't fit into what they can do, there's always something for them to do. I think, you know, it's disempowering when we tend to believe that we have to deal with certain things just because that's what's out there. And, you know, for us, you know, coming from different organizations where people didn't believe that we were going to start an organization. They, you know, some people really did not trust that we were going to continue the work. I think it was even more important for us to really prove that we were going to. And from that, I think that's where perhaps, you know, I don't want to say the word popularity, but perhaps it's a connection that we have to others because of the fact that they saw, hey, they were three activists, you know, that came together and they decided to do it and they did it. So we want to show that activists don't even need us. They don't need VAA. You can go out, if you don't have three friends that are vegan activists, you can go out by yourself and stand with a TV or stand with a sign and protest the exploitation and the murders of other than human persons. And, you know, within the liberation movement, that's what it is. It's fighting for liberation. There is absolutely zero reason to adhere to any type of branding because this isn't a business. This is activism. And so for me specifically, you know, I've become sort of disappointed in seeing that in this liberation movement, it isn't something that exists in any other social justice movement. And I think it is dangerous and we're not going in the right direction.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because I think a lot of the organizations do think like businesses and that can become dangerous. I know. Money rules the world and we still live in a capitalistic society. Ben and I have talked about how to change that, but we're still there. And so a lot of organizations think in that regard. But when it comes to social justice, anyone can do any kind of activism at any point in time and doesn't have to fit with, you know, like I said before, like your schedule. The SAVE movement only meets on Tuesdays and Saturdays and you're free on Fridays. You can go to a slaughterhouse and hold up a sign, you know, like you don't have to be there with the SAVE movement to make a difference or do some kind of activism. So I wanted to ask you guys, cause you talk a little about being activists and activation. Why do you think it's important for vegans to be active? If they're already vegan, they're not contributing to animal suffering. So why the next step and be active at all?
Well, I think the thing is like, you know, a lot of us, you know, when we first go vegan, we think we're just doing enough. But to me, just being vegan alone is the bare minimum. And, you know, if we want to start propelling ourselves into a vegan world, we need to speak up for the animals and we need to do more than just, you know, be vegan. We need to get active and be out there and you know, get more people to become vegan and, you know, start doing some, you know, systemic change and everything that involves all different types of activism.
And just to expand on what Tom said, you know, there's two things I believe. I don't believe that educational outreach by itself is going to make the world go vegan, even though we do. Right. do activations and education and outreach, and that's why we're expanding into different things. And two, I don't think consumerism is also equates to animal liberation. So while we can make choices and boycott this system through being being vegan, not only do we then have to become activists and speak up for, you know, these other than human persons that are being exploited, but we also have to challenge how we think about the system that we live in and how, you know, this very system, which a lot of vegans support, and they see a vegan option or a new vegan brand, which in their minds, a lot of times, you know, they equate that with liberation, how it is problematic and how regardless of how much education we do need to do the work that's going to lead to systemic change. And when people talk about the 2.5%, you know, within our movement, they don't talk about the other 30% that has to be kind of on your side as well. So it's not just a 2.5% of the population. So I'm not in support of the, you know, or the point of view that we're going to liberate animals just through consumer choices. And so it's extremely important for us to work on systemic change, to be activists and to challenge our own views of activism and to learn from other social justice movements and how they enrolled people into, you know, fighting with them or alongside them, which is something that I think is problematic within our movement right now.
All right. So VAA is pretty outspoken about being creating a safe space for all groups, all oppressed groups. And while the focus is animal rights, there's still an awareness of human rights. So I'm sure you've already been asked this many times, but isn't animal rights just about animals?
You know, I wish life were that simple. I think when other activists tend to be concerned, and I understand that concern of, you know, is this going to water down the message? Is this going to take away from the focus of animal liberation? I understand that concern. I'm an abolitionist. However, we don't live in a vegan vacuum. The systems that have been set up on this planet have been set up by humans. The oppressive systems that we live under oppress animals, and they also oppress other humans. So, you know, in order for us to grow, we're going to have to enroll other groups, you know, to come to our side. And I think creating systemic change is much easier by working with various organizations and enrolling them into a consistent anti-oppression praxis, you know, in talking about veganism in that way versus, you know, just trying to individually change the world. During the pandemic relief that we were doing with Black Lives Matter of Greater New York, we were working with them to transition their operation to being fully plant-based. And so we're still in the process of doing that and framing veganism as liberation praxis and why veganism. And so we must understand that we have to enroll the world in fighting with us in order to create that change. And it isn't as clear as cut as saying, okay, well, we're just going to do it this way and not include others. We cannot afford to do that. We don't have enough numbers. We don't have enough people. There might be 5,000 vegans in one of our groups here in New York, and about the same 100 to 200 activists show up. So not only are we having issues in having people show up and being activists within our movement, and then we're saying that, okay, we're criticizing those who are trying to enroll others into our movement, which, you know, I don't like to use that word intersectional. I don't like to take away from, you know, that work. But, you know, not realizing that interconnectedness, I think only fails the animals. And, you know, I'm of that belief that people do recognize interconnectedness. So if you're Jewish and you are against anti-Semitism, you are recognizing that there's other oppression. Everybody on this planet is intersectional, for lack of a better term, because we don't exist in single issue lives. It's just impossible.
So what do you have to say to the people that'll say, okay, well, then shouldn't we be inclusive to all, which means also, you know, allow men's rights activists and people who believe that gender is binary and evangelical Christians who believe that, you know, homosexuality is a sin. Why, if and we're, racist. What's that, Kevin?
And racist and sexist.
Yeah, basically all the bigots. Yes. So, but if we're trying to be inclusive, why don't we include them?
I'll answer that. I just want to be clear.
These aren't my views. I'm just asking these people.
No. I understand your answer.
Well, I mean, to me, like, of course we want to be inclusive, but we don't want to include people that are against other people. You know what I mean? Like, to have someone who's against, say, trans people, like, to have someone included in that movement wouldn't make any sense because they're against other people. You know what I mean? Like, so we're inclusive, but of course we don't want people who are going to oppress others, you know, that kind of inclusiveness. You know what I mean? Like, that total inclusiveness where we're putting people who are going to offend other people, who are going to be against other people. We want everybody, you know, this is a peaceful environment. We want, you know, people to not be oppressed while we're doing activism, you know?
Right. So, you know, collective liberation and, you know, being inclusive does not expand to being inclusive of systems or others that have oppressive views or that feel that having those views is a right to oppress others. I mean, you know, and I'm very clear on that. And I think that a lot of times when we're having this conversation about, well, what does inclusivity mean? Then that means that we should have people who don't support, you know, LGBTQ rights and so on. And so I always find that interesting because it's very clear to me what is oppressive and what isn't. And one time I was having this conversation with an activist, and that was this question: how do you know what's oppressive and what's not oppressive? I found that to be an interesting question because he's an activist. And so, you know, my question to him was, well, if you're taking away or feel that somebody's rights should be taken away because of your personal opinion, then you are holding oppressive views. And so, you know, you can have those views, but when you're either taking a political stance and supporting bills that oppress other people or other beings, that is that's oppressive. And so I have a very clear outlook on that. If it's something that makes others not live in a peaceful manner, if you're disrupting somebody's existence on this planet to the point where it interferes with their right to live and live in peace, then that's what I define as oppressive. And so if you're going to come to an activation that we're doing and you're going to say to somebody, well, I'm not going to respect the fact that you want to be called they, we're going to have a conversation, and I definitely want to have an open dialogue, but, you know, you're going to understand that that's not acceptable because first and foremost, there has to be a level of respect. And any activist who's fighting for liberation should first understand what the definition of liberation is. So when I get asked those questions, I'm more questioning the activists and their definition of freedom.
Yeah, it seems like it's exclusive, and we should not be inclusive to those who are exclusive.
You know? Right. It's intolerance. And I think that can sometimes be used to say, well, we should not understand how things are interconnected because who gets to define what's inclusive and who gets to define what's exclusive. And, you know, people frame it as it being a slippery slope. And it's a hard line. I don't think it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty clear when someone is being exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a question. I'm thinking about it from the perspective of our priority and this might be wrong, but I'm sort of framing it this way just for the question. So bear with me, please. our priority is animal rights, but also we should focus on human rights because they're connected, because they both matter, because it's all social justice. But how do we convince others who are, say, involved in Amnesty International and who seem to focus exclusively on human rights to then also focus on animal rights? Because I find that it seems like there are more activists out there in that category. And they say, you know, we need to fix all the human problems first before we can deal with animals and think about animals.
I mean, absolutely. And I think that it is extremely challenging work. I think that there is space for it to be done, but it is extremely challenging. People are speciesists. You know, they connect better to other humans, or they recognize themselves in other humans. And even with that, they still oppress other humans. So I do think that it is extremely challenging. I don't want to make it sound like it's easy peasy. But I think one of the things, especially within marginalized communities, that can be done is to show how things are interconnected. So if, you know, if we're looking at, you know, somebody like an organization like LULAC at the moment, which they're, you know, working on the Boycott Meat initiative. And I think they're working with Mercy for Animals and other groups. And so this initiative has taken place because of COVID, because of just systemic issues and labor rights issues that have been around for very long. And so we have to know which organizations, obviously, to connect with in order to start from there. It may be more challenging to connect with an organization that is focusing on child trafficking, for example. But I think finding that common ground is extremely important. Understanding how the different systems are connecting, connected, understanding animal agriculture and how that's connected. I hate to use that term, and also slaughterhouse workers and their plight and what they're going through. And I think when we find that common ground, then we can build from there. It is much harder, obviously, to go to an organization where that common ground perhaps may not exist yet. And one of the things that I have noticed in my work as a liberation activist is, you know, in marginalized community, when you present it that way, they are open to veganism. They understand that you're there, obviously on behalf of animals, but that you're explaining it to them from a way that they can connect with it. And I have had nothing so far, but you know, I haven't received anything other than a welcome. Even during the pandemic relief that we have been doing, these marginalized communities, these students that are at high risk of being houseless, who are food insecure, they also, you know, want to know and want to learn and want to take care of their communities and take care of themselves and take care of their health, for example. And, you know, they have questions about how can I do this? And I think a lot of times we tend to forget those communities because it's not worth it. So we're always shooting for the lowest hanging fruit and okay, we're going to target this person or that person. And something that's very lacking within the general animal rights movement is how to connect to these communities. The world is, the majority is not wealthy. The majority of the world is not white. And so if we're looking to make the world a vegan place, we have to be inclusive and we have to find common ground with other people and with a global majority and with organizations that are working on labor rights, on different issues that perhaps affect humans, but in turn are obviously affecting animals.
So should animal liberation organizations include human rights messaging? Like, for example, you know, during, you know, everything that's going on with Black Lives Matter, should that be part of it? Should there be messaging about, you know, globalization and food sovereignty and things like that? Should that be a part of you know, even if it's not directly related, should it be a part of the messaging just to be inclusive? And if so, how do we do that?
I think absolutely it should be involved. You know, this this movement that we're in, you know, it's made of people. Like, you know, other movements are typically by the demographic, are made up by the demographic, but animal rights is by humans fighting for animals. So to not include any, you know, human rights, like, issues in the message, like, it's not doing a service to the people who are fighting for it. And it doesn't make an inclusive movement.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, we should always center the animals in our work, should always focus on the animals because that is our priority. However, you know, recognizing the different levels of oppression or just, you know, giving light to an issue doesn't mean that we're, you know, not focusing on that work. We, you know, there's no empirical evidence to what works, right? So I think a lot of times what people will say to us is, but there's no evidence that that works. Well, there's no evidence that your approach works either. However, we do know that people are turned off by your approach, you know? And we believe that we can be consistent in our messaging of animal liberation, that we can be very firm in our messaging about animal liberation. But I do believe that giving light to the issues that are going on, like Black Lives Matter, it's important because that is a global issue that's happening. It is a global movement. And, you know, we have activists of color. We have indigenous activists. We have black activists. We have Asian activists. We have all sorts, you know, of people in our movement. And so when a movement disregards that, then, you know, you feel disregarded. I mean, as a person of color, as a person who's Afro-Indigenous, how dare somebody look at me and tell me that, you know, let's say Black lives, Black lives don't matter in a way. I just kind of had that happen to me recently. And this was somebody who I thought was a friend who is an activist as well. And I work extremely hard for animals. I mean, that is what my life revolves around. I do human rights work as well, but, you know, at the forefront is always about, you know, my fellow earthlings. And so when we have these activists and we are saying, we do not recognize you, we do not see you, that's detrimental to a movement that is diverse. And this movement is extremely diverse, but even though that isn't what people see most of the time, because obviously images are picked and, you know, promoted in a certain way, but this is a diverse movement. And acknowledging that diversity and acknowledging that the very people who are in your movement also have to fight multiple levels of oppression. They have to fight, you know, have been fighting colonization for very long, which was a system that completely destroyed our food systems, which were highly plant-based. It's a disregard. And so obviously, yeah, I mean, I have a personal feeling about it because of my background, but we must acknowledge it, whether, like you said, whether or not we find common ground, because we're trying to enroll the world in what we're doing. You know, right now we're looked at as a fringe movement. We are right the little kid on the corner who nobody wants to talk to. And that's a problem. We are not in the general discourse. People are not talking about animal rights. You know, when you see an article, it's, you know, regarding any type of animal rights, it's something extreme where somebody tortured an animal, but there are no news, no frequent news other than on vegan publications about what's going on with animals. You know, people are now reporting on it like it's like human rights issues. So we have to truly understand where we are. We have to understand that so far what we've been doing, you know, the murders of animals are not going down regardless of the vegan options that we have. We have to insert ourselves in everyday conversations. We have to insert ourselves into the media. And all that I believe is only going to happen if we strategically think about how to do it and enrolling the rest of humanity.
So I'm curious to hear your thoughts here. I wonder if you think the world's getting better or getting worse. Because
of course. According to The Economist, it's getting better.
According to The Economist, okay. I'm curious because you guys do street activism and you talk to people on the street. And I know in my circle, at least, people know what the word vegan is. Even though the hardcore hunters who never would have interacted with a vegan, obviously they're interacting with me, but it seems like they know what the word is. They know what it means. And plant-based eating is at an all-time high, you know, billions of dollars. It keeps increasing every single year. So I see those things as it seems like it's gaining some traction and starting to become mainstream. But I don't want to be too political, but I will. The current president of the United States is not helping, you know, with certain issues regarding human rights. And so I feel like on that level, and in many regards, the world is going a bunch of steps backwards. So how do you guys feel in general? Do you think on the street level, from a day-to-day perspective, interacting with strangers, is it getting better or is it getting worse?
Well, I think on an individual basis, I think people are more aware and more conscious of what's going on. You know, doing outreach, when you have conversations, I have more positive conversations than I do negative conversations. And people are aware of all different issues. But I think as a whole, it's another story. I do think that we've taken a lot of steps back as a whole. But individually, if people are more aware and more conscious, if that makes any sense.
And just back to what you were saying with the current administration, not just human rights, but, you know, even with animals, with the bailouts that are going on, with the basic destruction of any laws and regulations that were protecting wild animals and land. So, you know, the current administration has also been very detrimental for our fellow earthlings. I do feel that there's a lot of access to information. I think one of the issues that we see is obviously people looking for things that confirm their belief, and sometimes that belief is not on the right side of history. It's not for the animals, and it's not even for people. So while I think in a lot of ways, I'm a very positive person, so I always like to think that things are getting better, we are doing better. It's something that's really hard to gauge. You know, the conversations that I have in my daily life are very positive. The conversations that I have during the activations are very positive. Whether that has to do with my approach or whether that has to do because we are advancing, it's hard to tell. Sometimes I speak to other activists that just tell me, you know, they have had terrible conversations with people. So it's hard to gauge. It's hard to gauge when you read the numbers of all the animals that have been murdered, you know, and I sit there and I open all the different data in the World Economic Forum and I take a look at it. And so the numbers are not going down. They're not projected to go down either. Even if I have very positive...
Sorry, which numbers do you mean? The number of animals being slaughtered every year?
Yeah, the number of animals being slaughtered every year. So from...
It's going up.
Land animals, and obviously with fishes, it's just more challenging. You know, the consumption of dairy also going up. So we're talking about on a global scale. So while I feel very positive in my day-to-day, once I look at those numbers, then I have a reality check that we have a long way to go. So, you know, it's hard to answer the question because it is something that's so challenging to, you know, to define.
Do you have any advice for maybe first-time street activists or someone that, you know, might be a little hesitant, that, you know, they see what you're doing and they think, oh, that's really that looks really impactful, but they're, you know, they're a little hesitant to maybe a little shy, nervous to start themselves. Do you have any advice for how someone can get involved and do something on the street with people?
Yeah. I mean, doing your activism the first time is always like a little nerve wracking, but I think if the best advice is just, you know, go into the group, meet the people. And I have not met an activism group that hasn't been, you know, very welcoming. Most activists are very welcome. They love seeing new people. So it's just one of those things, you know, just kind of got to get past like the, you know, the initial, like, I guess butterflies in your stomach kind of deal, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I'm a fan of the buddy system, and, you know, I think finding a friend, if you have a vegan friend, sometimes you don't have a vegan friend, right? If you're just the one person in your community. But, you know, if it's a new vegan who is looking to become an activist and sees an event that's out there, you know, I always suggest reaching out to the organizer and then that being your buddy for the evening. And if they're too shy to do that, just kind of maybe even the first time, you know, going and even not participating and, you know, just looking from a little bit far away. I think some people are very shy. It can be very uncomfortable. I mean, speaking up for any social justice movement can be intimidating. But I'm a fan of that. So either having a buddy or reaching out to the organizer. And if those two things are just too much to kind of do for the first time, just going and looking at it from far away. And I think the more you kind of see it, the more then you'll be comfortable and eventually join.
Yeah. And nobody has to really push themselves out of their own comfort zone. You can do as much or as little as you like, but exactly. Showing up is important, right? As long as you show up, you don't have to shout into the megaphone or you know, get into an argument with a counter protester or something like that. Just show up and show support. It's very simple.
Right, exactly. Just be there. And I think by just being there, you know, you start to get comfortable, and later on, perhaps you talk to people. And then after that, hopefully you go and do other different types of, you know, activations and outreach and so forth. You know, we all start there. I mean, I think that all of us were perhaps a little bit intimidated, you know, at first.
Yeah, of course. It's something that we're not used to. Mm-hmm. So it takes some time to get used to it, but yeah, it's usually just like one or two times and then you feel fine. Yeah. You said before that there's no data for what works. Is that true? I always thought that there would be some data on, like, I'm thinking of like vegan outreach, and the leaflets they hand out, things like that, but there's just no real good empirical data on what kind of activism works the most effectively. Most effective. Right.
I think the data that exists, you know, I think there are surveys and there's some data, and I think, you know, effective altruists are trying to compile some of that data. But there is overall no empirical data because we haven't been, you know, following different type of or different strategies or tactics of activism for 50 years or 60 years. So I think that there is some data, but not necessarily empirical data. And so that, I think that that's challenging, you know, for us in the movement. And I think that that's why we can stand to actually study other social justice movement and study what has worked for them and perhaps apply it within our own movement. So I think that the distinction is empirical data, perhaps, versus, you know, the small studies that they have, where when you take a look at one of that research that you're talking about, it was, you know, one demographic, perhaps 1,000 people or 2,000 people or 5,000 people within a short period of time. So it's extremely, extremely limited. I know that there are some things that are being done right now where they're starting to track it. I mean, I think now they're starting to track, you know, people who perhaps came into plant-based eating through health and then, you know, maybe went vegan after and so forth. But they're very, very small studies and research, so nothing empirical.
I just want to add too, as someone with a sociology degree, it's really difficult data to even compile.
Exactly.
And even with other movements that have been successful, I mean, you want to talk about, you know, the suffragettes and everything. We don't know even then exactly what worked. Mm-hmm. You know, it could have been a bunch of different things. We can't say this is what worked and this is what happened, because it's social change. It's mm-hmm. not all individual. It's a systemic issue. Yeah. So it's hard to just, I mean, surveys are unreliable at best. So it's not something that's easy to just, you know, to figure out, just look at it for a while and be like, okay. And like you said, yeah, 50, 60 years, like, because someone, you know, when you may do activism and someone might not leave their vegan, but you may have turned something on in their mind that eventually something happens to them and they change. So it's, I don't think we can actually ever track it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a challenging thing to track, as you say. And, you know, I think that when we speak about different approaches, what we have is our personal experience, which obviously is not necessarily empirical data. But I think we can look at least at how that has an effect on others, right? So if we're having an approach that is turning people off to activism, then as an organization, we can say, well, we're going to pull away from that, you know, type of approach. Because we want to create activists. So not just, you know, creating vegans, but, you know, empowering the people who are already vegan. And so, you know, one of the dangers, I think, in our movement right now is that there are a lot of organizations or some organizations that have influence that are promoting this idea that this data exists. And it doesn't. And what I feel it does is pull people away from doing different strategies and tactics, and pulls people away from learning more about our own movement and learning about the liberation movement. Because, you know, we didn't just spring up since 1940s where somebody coined a term. There's a history of humans, you know, challenging the status quo and talking about animal rights. And, you know, you see throughout history that whenever we have had the opportunity to make choices within our food system, we have thought about whether or not killing another being is the right thing to do. And, you know, this can go back to even, you know, Egypt and, you know, all these times before and Pythagoras. And so we have a history, and, you know, I hope that eventually activists, you know, research that and understand that we have done it for very long. This isn't new. And although we don't have that data, what we always need to do is challenge ourselves and our approach, because, you know, we need to try different tactics and different strategies in order to grow our movement.
Oh, well, speaking of different tactics, I wonder if anyone has tried. So I see these ads pop up on Facebook and Instagram sometimes. It's a projector screen, like from a little box that is almost handheld. Has anyone done that? Like put it onto a wall, a giant wall size projector screen showing the footage that we want the public to see? And then I wonder, is that maybe legally unacceptable? Because then, well, what is the rule there? Because
Kevin, I've done that. We've done that in Kitchener.
Oh, okay. I've never seen it done
on a big wall, and there's nothing they could do about it, even though people complained.
Okay, because I wondered about kids potentially seeing something that would, you know, be triggering. Do you guys know what the law is for that kind of footage being shown to the public?
Yeah, and I think Connie Spencer, she's known as Vegan Bad Girl. I think that that's how she started as well. Was projecting images onto a wall. I love to do that. in New York, but things are a little bit challenging here at the moment with the police. So we do have to navigate that. But I think it's wonderful. I think that it's a great way to get the images out there to people.
Well, what about on like tablets and laptops? You're standing in very crowded areas and in public. And what if there is, children that see that footage, and sometimes it can be pretty graphic, or say people with PTSD or, high anxiety or some sort of trauma?
Yeah, we've gotten that question before. And I think there was another group that wanted to work with us. I think they're out of Portland, who are doing something similar. And, we have parents that come up to the table, or if somebody is holding a TV, they might rush their kids off or cover their eyes. And, I'm a person that's diagnosed with PTSD, but I also, so I wouldn't want to trigger anyone who has PTSD. But, I wouldn't be honest if I said that was the first thing that comes to my mind when we're setting up. I do take it into consideration. So if there are children that are there, I will speak to the parent because I do not want to traumatize a child. It's something that's challenging to navigate only because that most of the time that child is being lied to. Most children don't want to hurt animals. But I think for the most part, the people that come to our, activations or that pass by are adults. It's rare if there is a child, and if there is a child, most parents just kind of hurry by and so on.
All right. Well, I want to, I think we're running low, running out of time, but, before we finish, what if somebody's listening and they're like, okay, this Vegan Activist Alliance, that sounds like a perfect fit for me, and they want to learn more. How can they learn more about the organization? Can they, start up a chapter in their city and their location? What's the best route for them?
Yeah. So, we haven't expanded yet, but we have people who've shown interest. So that's something we are looking into starting. Maybe Eloisa, if you can expand on that a little bit.
Are you guys exclusive to New York City at the moment?
So basically our approach, we have about 8 groups that are interested in joining the Alliance. So we are pulling away from doing chapters specifically. What we would prefer to do is for somebody to build their own, sort of community. And obviously we can guide them in how to start it, how to do the outreach, how to get involved in various ways in animal liberation. And that's because we want them to have autonomy. We want them to make, their own decisions. But one of the things that we want them to adhere to is the consistent anti-oppression, obviously the anti-specious and abolitionist approach that we have. So while we're not creating chapters, our goal is to create an alliance, to create more cohesion. And I think that we discussed everybody sort of working individually instead of us just overseeing everyone and limiting how much activism they can do. We just found that to be a little bit limiting for them if we approached it in that way. So, if anybody is interested in, starting something, we are here to support them and to train them and teach them on how to start that. Absolutely. They can reach us through Instagram, Vegan Activist Alliance, or Facebook, or veganactivistalliance@gmail.com. Our website is also up, and it's just veganactivistalliance.org.
Okay, great. We'll have all those links in the show notes for anyone who's interested, and they can learn more. It's a great idea. It's definitely great. I started my activism on the streets of Korea, talking about dog meat, and it wasn't easy, but I got used to it very quickly, and I thought, it was effective. There were a lot of people who stopped and had a conversation, and I felt like it was making a difference, however small. You know, you're just one person, but you can make a difference. So I encourage anyone who feels like they might be compelled to go out and do some kind of activist work to try this first.
Yeah. And I think one of the things about not having chapters and just empowering different people or different groups is to pull away from that branding and having to follow a specific look. I mean, there are things that work, right? So we can train an activist with, you know, this is how you handle perhaps these objections. This is how you set up. This works. This will get you better engagement with the public. But we just want to take away from the fact that, you know, perhaps previously or they might have had to adhere to a certain way of looking or doing this or that. Not saying that there aren't benefits to those things, but we really want to pull away from the whole, you know, branding activism approach.
Can they make their own footage then, I guess? Because that's sort of easily attainable. You can find footage of slaughterhouses on YouTube or wherever and just grab it and use it on the street. Or is there specific footage that you guys would recommend using if you're doing street activism? Because I thought of making my own. I actually had the thought of being like a chef, almost pretending to be a chef and saying, here's the recipe on how to make a beef burger. And then you just show like, you know, a cow slaughterhouse. versus a veggie burger, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've used Dominion. I think Dominion is a great film. You know, Tom, you know, has put it on all our devices. But one of the things that works in New York, especially if there are slaughterhouses in your area, is local footage. And the benefit to that is when someone is talking to you, they're like, well, this doesn't happen here. You can say, well, it's happening right here. So if you are in a location where slaughterhouses are there and you're able to get footage, obviously different states have different laws. And, you know, we're not suggesting that people go to prison or go to jail to try to secure this footage. But if you can't find it on the internet and you're able to find it by going into the slaughterhouses, definitely get it. In New York City, we have over 80 live markets alone. And that's just in the city. This is not even in the entire state. And so for our activations in the city, we tend to also use local footage, which is very impactful.
Yeah, local and recent, I think.
And recent.
Are important qualities to have in the footage, yeah, because I can imagine a lot of people saying, oh, this is a long time ago. They don't do it like that anymore.
But, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I would also recommend anybody who's trying to obtain footage to try to, I mean, it's very tempting to, like, if you see a video where someone's doing something out of the ordinary with abuse, but if you use standard practice that holds a stronger, I guess you would say, value, not value, but you know what I mean? Like,
more compelling.
More compelling, because you say this happens everywhere. This is standard practice. As where, like, if you show, like, an abuse case, yeah, it's very strong, and people see it and go, whoa. But then again, they could say, well, that's an abuse case. That might not happen everywhere. But if you show something that's standard practice, like what happens to the, you know, chickens going into the macerator, you know, that's standard practice. You tell them this happens all the time everywhere, and, you know, that gets a very shocking, it's very shocking to people.
Yeah, exactly. And then they don't have the excuse of it's just a bad apple, you know, just right. one bad slaughterhouse worker, and we got to get rid of them, and then the right. system's fine.
Yeah, and those videos that do show the one time thing, you know, they're strong, and like I said, but at the same time, it doesn't hold as much of a value as something that's standard practice.
I agree. And as an ex-undercover investigator, that's what I would say to the general public who doesn't know, based on my own findings, at least, which is very limited. The majority of people were just following the rules and not being egregious in their abuse. and the vast majority of abuse, which was a lot, you know, tons and tons of abuse, was because of these standard industry practices, you know, just following the rules.
Right, exactly. And I think that that holds weight because then, you know, we can demonstrate this is a systemic issue versus, you know, this is one worker, as you said, who you went a bit too far. And I think, you know, something when we're doing outreach and people are looking at this footage, and they think that that isn't standard practice, and you stand there and just say, yeah, this is what happens every time, every day. And that's where the shock comes in. So I think it's important to just show that this is systemic and it happens across the board. So I absolutely agree.
Yeah. And for the record, I think castration is something that is not shown as much as it should be shown. I'm not sure if you guys use footage of castration often, but to me, that's like really compelling for any male who's walking by. First of all, it's standard industry practice, and it's excruciatingly painful without any, you know, painkillers. Of course, there's no anesthesia. And it's just a minimum wage, unskilled worker doing the procedure on piglets for 8 hours a day, you know, just the whole 8 hour shift castrating piglets. So like, I feel like we should be talking about that more as a movement, just to let people know that that's happening.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, that it's one of the most horrific things. And, you know, I think that that's also a way to connect, hopefully, with the male population. You know, our movement is 80% women. So that's another demographic that we definitely need to grow. And those are things that, you know, just like when we talk about dairy and the mothers and the cows and the milk and how that happens, you know, how these animals are violated in order to produce milk. I think, you know, it's a similar approach that needs to be done in order to connect with the male population.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be very effective. Okay, so thank you guys for everything. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for talking about VAA. We will, like I said before, put all of the links that you mentioned in the show notes so people can learn more. And if someone wants to start their own, it's a very real possibility. You can do it. And it's not that difficult. There will not be a lot of strict procedures or rules. So you just get out there and start doing some activism.
Yes. All you have to have is the need and the want to liberate animals. That's it. That's our biggest requirement.
It's necessary and sufficient.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, thank you both for joining us, and we'll post this up very soon so you guys can share it with your audience as well.
Thank you so much, Kevin and Ben.
Okay. Thanks, Eloisa. Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay. And we're back. What'd you think, Ben?
Yeah, this is an important conversation because it's important that our movement is inclusive, and for a couple of reasons. A, because it's just the right thing to do to support human rights and fight against human oppression just makes sense. It's just the ethical option. But also, as we talked about during the episode, if we're excluding, well, not necessarily, you know, I guess the right might say they're not excluding, but if we're allowing for people with oppressive views to be in our movement, then we're not creating a safe place for people that are victims of that oppression. So then you're basically left with the option of, okay, so do I let all the bigots in and then everybody in oppressed groups will not feel comfortable doing activism with us? Or do we make sure it's a safe space for everybody that is part of an oppressed group by not allowing the bigots? It should be a really, really simple answer, no?
Yeah, you have to be exclusive to those who are exclusive, which it sounds like meeting violence with violence. I don't know.
Like hate, I hate the hate, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, I hate the hate, exactly. But I don't see any other way around that. You have to be all inclusive to those who are inclusive, you know, excluding the bigots. Because I don't know, I'm thinking of like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Bear with me here. when he pushes his finger into the hole of the dam, and then another hole pops open and water starts shooting out of that, and then he sticks his toe in that one, and then another one shoots out, and two more shoot out, and then you have like all these other problems. As you know, solve one problem, you have two or three more other problems to now solve. And so you have to look at it from the bigger picture of this is about social justice. It's not just about being laser focused and single issued on one thing only. You have to think about it from the perspective of we are all sentient beings. We are animals too. You know, like humans are animals. So we have to think about human rights while we're talking about animal rights.
And whether people like it or not, veganism is a very progressive leftist movement. It's a radical movement demanding social change, demanding a change to the status quo. The right, you know, conservatism is about not changing. That's the whole basis of it. It's sticking with conservative values and traditions. And veganism is about as radical left as you can go, right?
It's about as much change as we can.
Yeah. I mean, that's a massive change, right? That's a worldwide change everywhere. It affects every single person on the planet. So of course it makes more sense to align a radical leftist movement with other just basic human decency and ending human oppression. It makes sense. Aligning it with conservatives who don't want to change isn't really helpful to a movement that is desiring massive change.
I wonder if the listeners can tell who we're supporting this election. Seems like we're very vocal about who, you know, politically.
I'm not American, and I also don't like Joe Biden.
Yeah, you're not American, but I am.
I would vote for him on behalf of all the oppressed groups. He's not the change that's necessary. But whatever, that's a whole other conversation, right, Kevin?
No, I was just thinking about the definition of conservative, and I think the literal definition, you're right, it means to conserve. It means to keep things
as they are. The original conservative, the romantic conservatives, like out of the Enlightenment, were basically against liberalism, against capitalism, right? And now the conservatives are the most staunch capitalist supporters, because it's not about any sort of values. It's just about keeping things as they are.
I wonder why people are scared of change. It makes me wonder, you know?
You need to talk to a psychologist.
I guess if things are good, you want to keep things as they are. But
yeah, if they're good for you.
They're good for you, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. Clearly, they are not good for the billions of animals who are being raised for food on our planet. So that's what we want to change.
Right. Demand change. Just demand a change to it's, I mean, our society is a system of domination, and animals are one of those groups, or non-human animals are one of those groups that are being dominated by that system. So let's end the system of domination, and we end oppression of all groups, including non-human animals.
Yes. Well said. All right. That's a good place to end it. That's great. Good job, Ben.
All right. Thanks.
Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for the support. Please check out VAA. If you want to start activist work, that's a good place to start. Start somewhere. Go into the streets. Hold up a sign. You don't have to talk. Just show your support for the cause. And then it could lead to other types of activism in the future. The animals deserve it, and the other activists will appreciate your support. All right, so that wraps it up. Ben, as always,
the vegan.
Thank you for listening to the Live Vegan Podcast.